My guest this hour is a former BBC journalist, a great guy. He is an author. I'm going to plug the bejesus out of his books during this hour, just before he does. I'll beat him to it. And he is also the presenter of Not the BCFM Politics Show, which airs out of Bristol every Friday at 5 o'clock and is a great listen. He's just returned even from an annual sojourn to New Zealand. Let's welcome back our friend Tony Gosling. Welcome back, T. How are you?
Hi, Richie. Well, not quite annual in New Zealand. I just go out there when needed, really. It's not really a holiday, really looking after elderly folks, but it's a nice place to be doing that. Thanks for plugging the books a bit. The main object of that is, I mean, the weird thing, actually, is that both the books were commissioned books by publishers that then changed their minds. So, you know, I'm thinking to myself, hang on a minute, I put this time and effort into and, you know, put these things together, both very different. One is a bit of basically an investigation into the end of the Second World War deals between the Nazis and the British, specifically between Hitler's private secretary and Churchill's private secretary. And the other one is really more of an anthology looking at secret government since the English Civil War. And so very different, but, you know, interesting. I thought I was, but you know, every time if a publisher calls you up and says, here's an advance, which one of them did, you know, a big check, put this book together, we'll be publishing it in 18 months' time. You know, it's quite an exciting time and you get ready for it. And then for them to then come back to you and say, we're not really interested anymore, changed our mind. You know, it stinks.
It's sickening, is what it is, T. It's sickening. Yeah. We're going to talk about something. It's accelerationism. We're going to talk about that in great depth. But before we do that, let's run through some of the big stories this week just to get a few thoughts from you. What do you make of events in China and what appears to be some, you know, for the first time in a long time, some pushback from citizens there against the horrendous COVID lockdowns? What do we make of that? Something to cheer? Something to be excited about? What do you reckon?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it was interesting when Trump announced he was running for president. It was quite a long speech, about an hour long, and it's worth listening to. Towards the end of it, he started talking about some conversations he'd had, direct conversations with President Xi. And it's, you know, brilliant humor. He's saying to him, hey, come on, why don't you just admit it? You're the king of China. And he's going, oh, no, I'm president, you know. And he's saying, well, actually, you're president for life. He's a king. Why don't you just come out and be honest about it? You know, say you're the king. Trump. This is Trump for you. And of course, this doesn't go down well in China, particularly with these, the house arrest, basically, that people have been put under. The amazing technologies with these police drones that people have got to scan the QR codes on the drones as they whiz past and this kind of thing. I mean, it's very much a dystopic police state. But China is probably the only country in the world where you can get away with that because of the incredible sort of Chinese Communist Party top-down, the fact that everyone is so reliant on the state, and the state has actually done a very good job in planning their society to make sure that there are enough homes for people, etc., unlike here. You know, so there's a big dependence on the state in China, but it's now what's happening is that the state is starting to cash in its chips, if you want. So the public has been dependent on it for years, and it's now saying, right, now you're totally dependent on us. We're going to start to push you around and see what we can get away with. And they seem to be trying an experiment on the public there with these extended unnecessary lockdowns. And the human spirit is pushing back, isn't it?
It's pushing back. I tell you what's chilling, though. Photographs of detention camps, which look colossal, gargantuan things with the capacity to house maybe hundreds of thousands of people. And this is not bullshit. Like these look genuine. These internment or detention camps. Could it be that they hold that over the population, or they hold those camps over the population to threaten them, to keep them, you know, acquiescing? Or are the Chinese planning to put hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people, into detention camps?
Well, I think to a certain extent they have. Not, I don't know how many, but they are putting people into detention camps. They have been. And look, the thing that's most chilling about that, from my point of view, sorry to be so selfish about the poor Chinese people's plight, but there are elements in the West that are looking at this with glee, rubbing their hands, and they see China as a kind of test bed for a lot of the things that they would like to do. I remember seeing photographs of John D. Rockefeller over in Nazi Germany at the beginning, before the Second World War had started, but when they started incarcerating criminal communists and trade unionists and people like that, gypsies, etc., and some Jews in the concentration camps, in the labor camps, and looking at it, rubbing their hands, the Rockefellers from the States going, well, great, you've got imprisoned people in prison that you're just kind of getting to build things for you and make things for you. Wouldn't that be wonderful? And so there's definitely, ever since then and possibly before, there is this evil element in the West which has been looking at what's going on in China and seeing what they can learn from it, seeing what they can implement here. We've now got these clean air zones. We've just had one yesterday for the first time implemented in Bristol. It's called a clean air zone. There's actually no real need. We've looked at the figures of the how clean the air is. It's very clean. It's getting cleaner. And the idea here is to have these little cameras on every corner, following your car, tracking you. So really this is about, I think it's not only about, a toll, putting a toll on everybody who comes in a vehicle into the town. And we've just seen exactly what's happened in London with this, with the zone announcement that the zone is being extended right out to the boundaries of the Greater London area. So everybody that's driving around anywhere is being not only told, charge there, whatever it is, £12.50. What's that, about £4,000 a year, just to sort of go down to the shops back in a car. So it's a toll. It's just a way of raising money from everybody for just doing what you need to do, just to kind of get on and feed your family and get on with the day. So what we've seen is, I think it's also surveillance. Of course, they're tracking every single vehicle, seeing where people are, where people are going. What's happening with the increasing move to the cashless society, more and more surveillance and tracking. And so that's what bothers me most about what I see in China, is that there are people over here who are looking at this gleefully and saying, look, this is the way to get it implemented. We tried it in China and it worked.
And I see these signs in Greater Manchester. I live in Salford, near Media City, as you know. And I've noticed in the last few months, driving around, signs which have appeared on the footpaths, which you can see in your cars, saying that this area is under consideration for clean air zone, basically. So this is spreading out right across the country.
In Manchester, there's been a very good legal challenge and pushback against it, and political challenge too. Threatening Andy Burnham and saying, "Look, there's all sorts of problems with this. Loads and loads of poor people won't be able to afford it." So there's been political and legal pushback in Manchester. I think they wanted to introduce the zone there. I was actually with a group of people in Bristol looking at getting a legal challenge to the clean air zone in Bristol, based on the fact that they'd already reached the government targets for clean air that they said they were trying to get. And the lawyers we approached in Bristol just refused to take the case on and refused to be paid by us. We'd raised about £2,000 to get them to send a letter before claim into the council, and they just refused to do it. So this is a political decision by the lawyers that they're saying, oh, no, we think it's really good, all these green policies, So, we were going to do that. We couldn't do it. So I don't know exactly what the situation is in Manchester, but they're trying to roll this out right across the country. So not only are we paying for car tax every year for the maintenance of the roads, we're also paying the tax through the fuel we buy every year. We're now also going to be paying for every inch we drive on the roads. And this is, it's a slow bit by bit rollout. The Siemens is the company, the Nazi company in the Second World War, that was doing all the electronics for the German aircraft and tanks and stuff. So they're the company that are in charge of all this. And down in Poole in Dorset is the research centre and the development centre where they've developed all this technology to pull right across Britain. I don't like that. I don't want a Nazi company running our little cameras everywhere, keeping track of us. Do you?
No, I certainly do not. Just before we talk about Ian Davis' article, I'll put the website up. Ian, it's iandavis.com, dear listeners. I-A-I-N Davis, D-A-V-I-S.com. Before we talk about this really interesting piece that he's done on accelerationism, and we are talking about that next. Tony Gosling is our guest, thisweek.org.uk. Not the BCFM Politics Show, live every Friday at 5 o'clock. It's a brilliant program. It really is. I listen to it all the time. Tell me this. Elon Musk, amnesty for people who are kicked off of Twitter. I'll tell you why I don't buy it. Because ultimately it won't be governments that force Elon Musk to censor to censor people and to censor accounts. Ultimately the private sector will do that. We're seeing Apple already and Tim Cook. Musk has tried to engage the CEO of Apple on Twitter, asking him, why are you pulling your advertising? I don't buy this leniency and amnesty for people. I don't buy this free speech absolutism from Elon Musk. Am I wrong? What do you think, Tony?
I think you are wrong. I mean, I don't believe he is a particularly, you know, he's not some sort of guru. You don't want his poster up on the wall. But he's got, I think, a more lenient idea of free speech than the people that were running Twitter in the past. It's all a question of the lesser of various different evils, isn't it? I think, yeah, so Musk is most definitely, as Whitney Webb talks about, very, very, correctly, is part of the problem. But he has got a propensity to allow a bit more free speech, and so let's go with that. I was surprised to see the big tech giants and the people that own the stocks and shares in them, particularly in Twitter, to allow him to do this. He's obviously got quite a lot of financial clout, a lot of which has come, of course, through the all these fake green policies to do with electric cars and things like that, and driverless cars, which sounds like an absolute maniac would allow something like that to go on the market. So he's done very well out of that. But if he's going to allow more people, more free speech on there, which I think he probably will, and maybe allow people like you and Donald Trump back on, I've never actually been banned, even though I've been shadow banned on Twitter. I'll be pleased to see it, because Twitter is quite a useful tool. I think that though these algorithms, this is one of the things that's coming out about the online harms bill, which is now called the online safety bill. And we've heard today very good news that they're going to be taking out this clause in the bill in the UK, which was saying that if you can be prosecuted for having something which is legal but harmful on there, well, not prosecuted, but having your content removed. And if you don't remove the content, the service provider will be threatened legally, and where the service provider can be fined if they don't remove your content for you, or remove your entire website effectively as well. Now that being taken out of the act, the bill as it is really good news, I think. And anything that allows a bit more free speech on the internet. Listen, we've had a golden age of the internet. Like there in the 60s and 70s, we had a golden age of television, and we really got to do everything we can to stop the clampdown, as it's the only place of free speech left, really. I mean, I've been elbowed off the airwaves. You've been elbowed off the airwaves. And this is the only place we can still talk to listeners and help inform people, because the people who we are up against are very powerful, and they like to make sure that their narrative gets out there and voices like yours and mine get squashed, literally. I mean, this is a Soviet-style system where, you're not going to allow criticism. This is the Chinese system where you don't allow the president. You know, you can't laugh during the national anthem and this sort of thing. Now, I think it's essential to laugh at the national anthem, every once in a while. And maybe not on Remembrance Sunday with a load of veterans around. That's probably not the best time to do it. But the idea that it's a crime to do it, that is where we're headed if the internet is shut down. And it's good to see Musk, he's probably going to allow a bit more speech. And it's also great to see this announcement today, really good news to see this announcement today about the online safety bill.
Okay, final word on that. LiveLeak.com's Hayden Hewitt, who is a good friend of mine and looks after the website for me, is convinced and has been for some years that we're blindsided by what governments are doing with social media companies. Ultimately, the private sector will drive the censorship and will drive the paradigm into dystopia, is what he believes, and he's convinced of it. He makes a compelling argument.
He may be right. Yeah, I think he may well be right. I think the government has been pretty much co-opted by these various lobbies, and the tech giant lobby is a very powerful one. You know, we've obviously got the pharmaceutical lobby, the arms lobby. These private interests now, I think, are far stronger than individual governments, and this is why our MPs are actually quite important to be able to push back against these people. Otherwise, what we've got is this kind of fascistic dystopia where the drive for private corporate profit is all that matters in society, and that anything that threatens it is legislated against and shut down and criminalised. You know, we've seen, the activities of the police basically shut down. The CID departments across the UK over the last 20 years investigating criminals have just been closed. I mean, there's very, very little of that goes on at all now. No investigation of organised crime because, as we saw 2 years ago when the government implemented this bill to which the Labour Party didn't even bother to oppose, to allow government agencies to have complete free rein and break the law with impunity. I mean, that to me was just like the death knell of democracy, and it was a sign, a very sure sign, that organised crime was now running the government. So all the little things that we can have pushing back against that are, very, very important and well worth preserving. But your friend at Live Leak, I think, is right about the pressure of these various lobbies is becoming immense, and, goodness knows who's going to win out in the end.
And they've all the money in the world. Tony Gosling, the broadcaster, former BBC journalist, is our guest. Ian Davis is a former councillor. He's a blogger and an author. He has written an article. You can find it at his website, iandavis.com. Ian is spelled I-A-I-N. And it's about something called accelerationism and accelerationists, the people behind it, people who argue the technology, computer technology, capitalist technology should be expedited, should be sped up and intensified, particularly in times like these. Now, he says in his very, very good piece, very in-depth piece, Ian, that it's a fairly new concept to him, but it's been around since the 1970s. I know that it isn't a fairly new concept to yourself, Tony. Give our listeners a definition that we can understand accelerationism and explain how it's working today.
Well, I think it's really important. I jumped onto ZB News Talk, which is one of the best radio stations in New Zealand, where the guy that does the breakfast show on there has been banned from press conferences by Jacinda because he's asking her too many awkward questions, which is always a good sign to talk about accelerationism. Because I was prompted to do it. It was some intelligent young New Zealander phoned in to the phone-in and said, well, look, we keep hearing about the government is doing this for ideological reasons, the government's doing that, it's privatizing water, in even though it's a left-wing government over in New Zealand, and they're trying to take control of the water on people's roofs and God knows what, and people's boreholes, etc., and their septic tanks. There's a lot of people out in New Zealand are living out in the what they call the wop-wops, out in the middle of nowhere in the bush and places like that, and the government's trying to take over all this water. And but what she said was, look, what is this ideology? It's an ideological thing they're doing, and trying to shut down livestock farming, things like that. And the answer is, and I phoned in to say the answer is accelerationism. That's what the ideology is. And what Ian's done is he's shown in this article various uses of the word accelerate. And we're going to accelerate this, we're going to accelerate that, we're going to accelerate change. Now, what accelerationism really is about accelerating crises. Now, we all know about Naomi Klein and the shock doctrine. The idea is you create a crisis, you create panic, you create chaos of various sorts, and then you control the outcome. People are much more prepared to accept your solution if it's a way out of some kind of chaos. So it's a pretty simple concept, really. But the thing is, where does it end? Where do these crises end? Is it a war? Is it going to, is it economic crisis? Is it having all the, we've got this crazy situation in the UK now, where we could be looking at power cuts. Well, you know, the Ukrainians have just had the Russians blow up their power supplies, and so they're having power cuts, but we haven't had anyone blow up our power supplies, as far as I know. They're just saying, oh dear, oh dear, I'm very sorry, but we haven't actually got enough electricity to go around. Well, I think what they're doing is they're choking off the supply a bit to jack the price up. So, you know, it's an excuse to just increase the price by shutting off these old coal-fired power stations and gas stations and things like that. You know, it's an ideological reason, but the ideology is accelerationism. And what he's, I think, very importantly saying in this article, which I think is the best I've seen so far on this idea, is that the whole accelerationist idea is ultimately going to make, I mean, the idea is, for example, the climate crisis, the solution to the climate crisis is going to be far worse than the climate
crisis.
This is the idea, is that you create a solution to whatever crisis it happens to be, which is actually going to make it worse. It's not going to be a solution. Brilliant article. And I think, you know, this is exactly what we're seeing going on here with the, oh dear, we've got this terrible climate change thing going on, so we're going to have to shut down all of our oil-fired power stations. And oh dear, no one's going to be able to heat their homes, not just because they can't afford it, but also because they're going to be, the electricity is going to be switched off. So this is the sort of thing he's talking about in the article, which I think is brilliant. But the reason I asked you if I could come on is because I was interviewing David Livingstone. This is the guy who wrote, amongst other books, including The Dying God, which is a brilliant look at ancient belief systems compared to today, is Transhumanism, the History of a Dangerous Idea. And his look at transhumanism, I think, is one of the best I've ever seen. Now, Alan's in the middle of interviewing him. This is about 2 or 3 months ago. And for my show, and I think it was about the death of Alexander Dugin's daughter, because he's done a lot of work on Dugin and her assassination over in Russia. And he mentioned this guy's name, and at the end of the interview, after I'd finished, I said, look, who is this guy, Nick Land, this accelerationist guy who's one of the main authors of it, on ideologues? I said, I think I know him. I think actually he was my best mate at school for a couple of years between the age of 14 and 16. And it turns out it's the same guy.
No way.
So I know, and that's exactly what he said. No way, no yeah. way, in his own voice. So, I mean, it's interesting to look at Nick. I mean, he was known when we were at school, in the secondary school. It was a grammar school, Langley Park School, 1973, I think, was when I went there. And then, roughly, anyway, it was a grammar school. In 75, Shirley Williams turned it comprehensive, and, of course, it went rather downhill after that. There's a few things about our school. It was next door to the Wellcome Trust, which is, I mean, you couldn't make this stuff up, could you, really?
No.
That was their main base in the UK, at Park Langley, which was a big... it was basically a big mansion house where actually Chris Busby, I was chatting to recently, worked there whilst I was at school. He was just across through the fence working in the Wellcome Trust buildings there. And Nick was known as Nick the Nazi at school. Now, you might say to me, what were you doing as friends with Nick the Nazi? Well, okay. Nick the Nazi was very intelligent and a fascinating guy, very dark sense of humour. And it was weird because in 1978, after I'd known him for 2 or 3 years, he suddenly came back after the summer holidays. I hadn't been able to get in touch with him. I'd been around to his house a lot. I got to know his parents, his brother, etc. And he disappeared during the summer holidays. And he came back in 78 when we came into the sixth form. He was a communist. He was no longer a Nazi. So I found it absolutely fascinating. Kid really, we used to play war games a lot, you know. So I'd go around to his place and we would play, for example, the 6 Day War. This is when we were like 15 years old, and we'd spend most of the afternoon being supplied by sandwiches by his mum and cups of tea, fighting. You know, he'd be the Israelis, I'd be the Arabs, or the other way around.
And how would you do that? How would you do that? How did it work?
Well,
reenacting
okay,
this
so,
war.
Yeah. So it's basically, these are tabletop war games. So
wow, I didn't know.
Like with a map and little counters. So I mean, you know, okay. So sad little 15-year-old kids.
No, I'm not saying that at all. That's not what I'm inferring. I genuinely didn't know these things existed. I'm fascinated.
Yeah. So it's I think it's like Avalon Hill, where big game producers in the States. There was a book called, a magazine came out called The War Gamer here in the UK, which would come every month or every 2 months or something. You get a little war game with it, like you fight the Battle of Tobruk or whatever. And it just taught me a lot about war and about the way war operates. And you know, and I really did like Nick. You know, he was a Nazi. He was had Nazi sympathies. But, you know, he didn't seem to me like a particularly, you know, he took it seriously. It was almost like he was dangerous. a kind of tongue-in-cheek thing. Yeah. So it was a bizarre place to be. You know, we were very close to, for example, the area where, I mean, we used to go out and mess around as a sort of, he set up this thing called the British Free Army, which was about eight of us who were a sort of guerrilla unit. You know, we were only sort of 14 years old, so, you know, you're kind of messing around, and we would do operations on the like interesting stuff. Like, for example, in the nighttime, we had to get from one, Nick's idea, of course, we have to get from one side of the common, which was about a mile, through the common at night on our own. So the idea is overcome fear, you know. Right. So anyway, so the thing that interested me so much about Nick was that he had this kind of massive amount of knowledge, and I had no idea, he hadn't learned it at school, where it came from, really. His dad, by the way, was a director of Shell in South Africa, which obviously was a, you know, was a bit of a hot potato in the late 70s, 1980s, as South Africa was, you know, under a very strict apartheid. Yeah, there was a very strong anti-apartheid campaign in the UK. Incidentally, I did try and contact, once I found out about this, I did try and contact Nick through a mutual friend who's up at Worcester College, who's a fine art teacher, who'd known him when he was at Warwick, because he went off to, after school, Nick went off to Warwick University, and Nick didn't, you know, hasn't got back to him on, hasn't got back to either of us actually, but so he was at Warwick University, and he became one of the senior lecturers in philosophy after we left school. He went to Sussex University and studied down there, where I visited him, where, by the way, they were making LSD in the organic chemistry labs. Not him, but
not him, but somebody else. But, I mean, this is a guy, hang on, let me get this right now. This is where we put my powers of listening to the test. This is a guy who had Nazi sympathies, but ended up turning kind of communist. He's going to this school with you, next door to the Wellcome Trust. Jeremy Farrar runs that today. It's really interesting stuff. Right. His old man is in Shell at a time when, you said it yourself, but of course all the issues with petrol and oil and shortages in the late 70s. This is a really interesting character. You know what's going to happen, don't you?
Profiteering. The important thing about profiteering in this apartheid state, you know, putting down the local population, very much a sort of old style, you know, racist style colonialism still, really, in South Africa back in the 70s.
Hang on a second. Do you think, so this guy now is, these days he lectures in philosophy, sociology, something
not,
like that?
Not now. I mean, he's now over in China.
Right, so he's a spook then. You think this guy's a spook, right? This is why you're telling me about this
guy.
Well,
I don't know. No, I don't think so necessarily. No? I mean, quite what he's part of, I don't know. I don't think he's just, so when he was at Warwick, he's a big, and even when he was at school, he was really into Nietzsche. Of course, Nietzsche is Hitler's number one philosopher. Nietzsche is the man who is about as anti-God as you can get in philosophy. His book Beyond Good and Evil, Man and Superman, he thought the idea that man was just a wimp believing in God and had to become, which also fits in with transhumanism, doesn't it, in a weird way?
It does, yeah.
So when he was up in Warwick, this mutual friend of ours who I met recently from Worcester College, the fine art teacher, was saying Nick was conjuring or trying to conjure demons whilst he was a philosophy lecturer at Warwick. He was living in a house which used to be owned by Aleister Crowley up there.
Your kid, give over. This is where you say to me, April fucking, I'm not stupid. You think Irish people are stupid? I'm not buying into this. So now all of a sudden he's in a house that Aleister Crowley used to own, and he's trying to summon demons, presumably with a Ouija board.
Well, I've no idea, but it's in the Guardian article. There are a couple of articles. Ian Davis refers to the Guardian article, which I think was 2017, one of the Guardian long reads about the accelerationists. I think the headline is something around the accelerationists are predicting the world. How did the accelerationists predict the world we're now living in? You know, so there was definitely something, you know, peculiar up there. I spoke to several people who were with him up at Warwick afterwards, and he was always quite secretive about his past down at Langley Park with people like me. But, you know, the other aspect of this is the hallucinogenic drugs. Nick was really, I mean, you know, I wasn't adverse to, you know, taking an interest in things like magic mushrooms, but Nick was absolutely obsessed with it. In fact, one of his near roommates down at Sussex University when he was down there doing philosophy said to me, oh, well, like, you know, he's on LSD almost every day, you know, so, you know, we think it's a little bit over the top. So there's obviously he's got an interest in these drugs, and you know, I don't hold that against him in any way, but he was a bit obsessive. But the other thing is this whole idea of game theory seems, you know, Nick was really into this whole idea of, look, if you can turn anything into a game, then you can get a kind of, you know, chess computer to look at it. You can win it. You can win whatever situation you're in. If you turn it into a game, you win. You can win.
So turn life into a game. Turn this kind of lurch towards social crediting, implantables, the metaverse. Make this somehow game-like for people, the reality they're in, and they'll participate in it? Is that where it goes? Something like that?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I think that's it. I mean, Nick's definitely got, I mean, one of the great sort of saving graces of Nick was, and it's a real pity that he didn't respond, because I'd love to have had a discussion with this about him and record it. You know, maybe he's just a bit hesitant about speaking to someone that he knew at such a young age. But I can remember the last conversation I had with him, other than on the phone, which, you know, I was chatting with him when he was up at Warwick a few times when I was at the BBC, actually, but was when we were at school, before we went to college, before he went to university and I went off up to Ilkley to study English. It was about Christianity, and I stopped him on the stairs, because he was, by that point, he was off on another thing. He was after girls and things like that, and didn't see so much of him when we were sort of 17, 18 years old. And I stopped him. I said, Nick, one of the things I always wanted to ask you is about God. Yeah. Because, you know, you are always arguing against God, but you can't really prove it, can you? What do you think? And he said to me on the stairs at the sixth floor block at Langley Park, he said, well, actually, it's about 50-50, really, isn't it? And then he turned and dashed upstairs. So, you know, he was, I think, in a way, he was playing life like a bit of a game, you know. So I'm going to have some fun here and play with all these various different ideas, which, you know, I sort of like that about the guy, that he was playing with ideas. But I just think, you know, particularly with the drugs, you can become obsessed. You know, you can start to think that what you're seeing when you're hallucinating on one of these drug trips is more real than reality. And a lot of people have flipped out. And I wonder whether, because I think the reason he got elbowed out at Warwick was to do with giving drugs to students and things like that. It was something like that was going on up there. I just think it was, you know, it's useful to just unload a bit of this, because it's been kind of boiling up inside of me to talk about Nick, you know, because it's so bizarre that I should know somebody.
Well, we have to reach, it's incumbent upon me to try and reach the guy now to cover my arse and to say, listen, we've been discussing you unexpectedly on this programme. It'd be lovely to get right of reply. There's only two real journalists left in the UK. You're one and I'm the other. I'll try and find the guy. Nick Land, is that his name,
Nick Land. He's the author of several, he's written some books. I found them very dull. I did actually buy one of his books to see what's Nick writing about, and I just couldn't finish it. In fact, there's also a very good article, which I'm happy to send you, written by Mike Peters, who became a friend of mine. He's dead now, but he was a sociologist at Leeds Metropolitan University, and he wrote the best paper on the Bilderbergers I've ever seen. I think it came out about 1996, called Bilderberg and the Project for European Unification. But Mike did an article in his own Here and Now magazine, which was a situationist magazine that he and some other lecturers and I suppose sort of intellectuals of various sorts in Leeds used to put out, called Here and Now. He did an article about Nick, bizarrely, called Cyber Drivel. In the here and now, and it is an absolutely brilliant, entertaining. It's looking at Nick and his kind of ramblings in philosophy, and how it all was a load of nonsense and rubbish.
Is
he's basically
right?
saying that you know, we're going to be living in this amazing kind of, you know, one of the other things, and which connects with this is William Gibson. Nick got me into William Gibson. Nick got me into Deep Purple, Jimi Hendrix, and various other things when we were that age, you know. But William Gibson, the author, who's a cyberpunk writer, and this is another amazing thing. This is 1979. I'm having conversations with Nick. Nick is telling me about the internet. Oh, by the way, the internet's going to be coming along soon, blah, blah, blah. Now, this is, where are we? Now, 15, 16, 17 years before it really became the internet and it started rolling
out. And he was talking about it, was he? By the way, in case listeners want to know, there is a Wikipedia page for Nick Land, and it's really interesting. I've been listening to Tony and reading it at the same time, so you can check it out. It's very, very interesting. This is a guy we must speak to. Either you must speak to him. I mean, it'll have to be you. You're his old schoolmate. And then we have to start doing a bit of digging down into you and find out who Tony Gosling really is, that he know, that he knows all these people, because they'll be calling you some sort of shill now. But this is some of the stuff he's been into, this guy. You've described it all brilliantly there. The occult cybernetics, post-structuralist philosophy to describe the phenomena of techno-capitalist acceleration. This guy's really, really interesting. To say the least, this guy. Hey, listen, you mentioned Aleister Crowley.
Yes.
Old friends of mine and new friends believe that Crowley, the famed or infamous occultist, was in reality working for MI5, was he?
Well, I think he was very close to the intelligence services. I forget who it was now, but somebody very credible, oh gosh, wish I could remember who, was talking about Crowley being one of the first people to interview Rudolf Hess when he landed and was arrested. He landed in Scotland, crash-landed, and I think he parachuted down, didn't he, when he fled Nazi Germany. Yeah, I think he was very close to the intelligence services. There's two, as far as I know, connections with between Nick and Crowley. One is this area where Nick's parents live, just on the edge on West Common Road of Hayes Common, near Hayes. I mean, I used to bike to school. Nick would take the train from Hayes to Eden Park. And that, just connected to that, is this, well, it's the US ambassador's house is there. It's a place called Locks Bottom. And it's a big private estate. And I can always remember as kids, we'd go past there from time to time and just wonder at this. It was a kind of piece of stonework next to the bus stop on the edge of this big private estate, which had a satanic symbol written in the stones there. And if you look back on the Guardian website, some of the stuff they've put up from the old days, which is now online, from the 1930s, there's a letter by the principal or vice principal of, I think it's Oxford University, telling Aleister Crowley, no, you cannot come and speak because you're a Satanist. You cannot come and speak to the Poetry Society at Oxford University. You're not welcome.
Cancel culture was alive and well back then, was it?
It was, yeah. And it was addressed to Aleister Crowley at Locks Bottom.
Locks Bottom.
In the same place.
What about listeners? A very, very good friend of mine. I've got two very, very good friends texting me as we speak. They're fascinated by this. One of my very good friends reckons that MI5 probably worked for Aleister Crowley.
Yes, well, I think the intelligence services, initially was set up with a decent principle. The idea is that, you know, we need to know what's going on in order to avert threats and things like that. There's no sense in having an army on the field without knowing, you know, what the other side is up to. And the occult, I think, have infiltrated that in a big way. And in fact, a lot of criminals have infiltrated it, knowing that when they're working within that atmosphere, then they can get away with their crimes and no one's going to worry about it. You have to remember, of course, that, say, back in the 30s and 40s and, you know, 50s, up until the 60s, that homosexuality was illegal.
Yeah.
And so a lot of gay people realized that they could go and, you know, work in the intelligence services and they were going to be basically above the law, you know. So there was
Hang on, that's fascinating. I didn't know this. Did some gay men seek out work in the intelligence agencies for the very reason you just gave? Because
I think most definitely. I mean, you look at the, for example, the Cambridge spies, is it Burgess, McLean, Philby? I'm not sure which of them were gay, but certainly most of them were. And what's his name? Blunt. Were, and also, I don't know about Victor Rothschild. I'm not sure, because he was, certainly in my opinion, the fifth man. If you read Roland Perry's book, Roland, it'd be great if you could get, if you've not spoken to Roland, he's still alive after writing this book in the 1990s on Victor Rothschild, called The Fifth Man, which is an incredible piece of journalism. He's an Australian guy who worked in Fleet Street for a long time. He's now back, I think he's at Sydney University teaching over there. But Roland, you know, so yes, a lot of there was a lot of that. And of course, the idea being that these people had been fighting against the ruling class in, you know, for, I suppose, pretty good reasons, really, thinking that, you know, the establishment in Britain were just, you know, a horrible bunch who all they did was just take the mickey out of the poor, squeeze the poor for every penny they could get, every drop of blood, send them to war, etc. And so there was a decent sentiment there. But many of them who ended up actually in the Soviet Union realized, oh, actually, well, the Soviet Union is hardly the answer, because it's, you know, it's been expunged of its spirituality. It's been, you know, God has been completely, like, well, not made illegal, erased. But there was just hardly any, you know, idea of this spiritual side. And so they were kind of conned by that. And
we're
anyway,
seeing that
so,
today. Can I just mention this? It's 18 minutes to the top of the hour. We've got Tony for another 10 or so minutes. You're listening to Tony Gosling, thisweek.org.uk. We've been talking about accelerationism and how that's linked to the transhumanist agenda. And a very interesting guest on last night from the United States, Dr. Jason Dean from Florida, who's in private practice with his wife, and he is seeing how, you know, smartphones won't be, they won't be the thing in 10 years' time, because it'll be implantables. He very good last night on this program. And Tony's been linking some of this together in the last half an hour, speaking about a guy called Nick Land. Do go to Wikipedia. The Wikipedia page alone is very interesting. Do read iandavis.com. Read Ian's article on accelerationism. This has been an amazing hour so far. Fascinated by it. Alistair Crowley as well. Nigel Farage is trending on Twitter, as is Enoch Powell. I'll give people the requisite 3 seconds to laugh out loud. The reason Enoch Powell is trending is because Farage has had a bit of a meltdown about the census information that emerged today. The ONS put out some information about the most recent census, which was last year, of course. We all got the letters through the letterboxes. We all filled them out. And some of us told a lot of lies in theirs, as I did. I declared myself to be a non-binary former member of the Chinese Communist Party. No, I didn't. So we filled out the census forms last year, and it turns out that for the first time ever, less than 50% of people in Wales and in England identify as Christian. I'll get Tony's thoughts on that in 10 seconds. But also that there are 1.2 million more Asian people and possibly Muslim people in England and Wales than there were 10 years ago. Nigel Farage, of course, in reality is delighted about this because it keeps him in the news, gives him something to complain about. But Enoch Powell, does history remember Enoch Powell unkindly? Was Enoch Powell a racist, or was I right when I watched Enoch Powell speak with the great Dick Cavett in America? Was Enoch Powell posing legitimate questions at the time about society? What was he, do you think, Powell? Was he just dyed-in-the-wool, filthy racist, or was there something else going on? What a question.
Well, with Enoch Powell, he wasn't just a dyed-in-the-wool, filthy racist. He was pointing out that we were going to lose our cultural identity. Now, that might be good or bad, depending on which attitude you know, a lot of the Irish would be rather pleased to see the English lose their cultural identity. But, he was warning that Rivers of Blood he talked
Rivers
about?
Of
he was
Blood,
saying,
the
look,
famous
you know,
speech.
We could be looking at race wars here. Yeah. And, of course, there's been attempts by the state to get those race wars going. I think the human nature of the Brits is actually not quite like that. There is an understanding, I think, that, you know, a nation like like Britain, that's had such an enormous empire, has got to kind of take it on the chin. You know, you've exploited all these countries, and then so some people from those countries are likely to come and want to exploit you, or at least, you know, take advantage of some of the benefits of empire and come back. But I mean, you know, obviously there is this attempt at the moment to bring many economic migrants into the UK. What that does is it keeps house prices up, number one. Number two, it's a massive load of cheap labour. It's extremely good for organised crime. The organised criminals have got a whole load of workers for them, and it undermines your national integrity, of course, by having, you know, you not being able to control your borders. So I think the government is basically, what we've got is we've got a government that was elected to do Brexit, and actually the Europeans and organised crime in Europe is saying, well, look, you've got no Brexit at all. Look, we've got just as many people coming in as when you tried to get out of the EU. So up yours, you know. So I think that's basically what this is about. It's an attack on Britain for Brexit.
And most people are none the wiser, because it works. This race baiting works. It does turn man against his brother, woman against her sister. It will do what it was designed to do. The Albanians coming over for a better life. Yes, they are aided by criminal gangs, but they're only doing what I would do. You know, it's what I did do. I'm a migrant in this country. I'm an Irishman. I came here because things were better for me here than they were in Ireland back when I first came here many, many years ago. So I can see that, and I can see why they want to collapse civilization, why they want to collapse the welfare system, why they want to collapse the employment. We can see that, but the majority are still driven by the media narrative, and they do what they are meant to do, the other people. And it's so hard to break through that, Tony, isn't it?
Well, I don't know. I think, you've got the very genuine difference between the unionised labour and the scab labour, you know, so that's very real. People who are trying to protect their, you know, working together in an industry to try and protect their paying conditions, and other people who are coming along to undermine that, who are going to work for next to nothing and don't really care about the long term. So, I mean, there's been obviously attempts to set people against each other. Of course there has. So the wider question about Christianity, this is the fault of the mass media, I think, mostly. And it's also the fault of the Freemasons in infiltrating the church, Satanists infiltrating the church. One of the main, the Satanists have got two main objects. One is abortion. They love abortion for whatever reason. But the other one is infiltrating churches. As soon as they see a successful church, they want to send people in there. They want to, you know, send someone in who's on the kind of nicey-nicey, but is going to try and undermine it. And they get a kick out of undermining churches. So there's been a big operation, I think, against churches. I mean, if you go back to the one of the best conspiracy tomes ever written, which is The Proofs of a Conspiracy Against All Religions and Government by John Robison in the 1790s, there's what he talks about: infiltration of the churches. You've got to infiltrate the churches. You've got to come up with all sorts of different organizations under a different name, but really it's controlled by you. And you don't need to be a genius to go around and work out, well, there's, you know, various pressure groups out there that are pushing for basically immorality. You know, this whole idea of the transgender people who say that they can just self-identify as whatever it is, a mermaid, a cat, this totally undermines people's kids, particularly, sanity. You know, what you're saying is that the reality is no longer reality. Reality is whatever you say it is. And this is totally undermining any possibility that kids have got to make sense of the world.
Fair enough, T. I want to mention before we run out of time, it's important that we support the independent media. So I'm going to mention them. I am. You're not to mention them, or you're going to have to pay me for the privilege. Please do pick up a copy of The Traitors of Arnhem, Martin Bormann and the Bilderberg Group, or Another excellent read, The Siege of Heaven, How Breaking the Grip of Oligarchy Will Unleash the World's Human Potential. These are books by Tony.
Actually, that one's not available as a paperback. That's just as an e-book. But the Siege of Heaven reader, it's a slightly different title, but it's a completely different book, which is the anthology. I think for anybody that doesn't want to read me, you know, scribbling away, this is other people's writing. I've just acted as an editor here and brought together what I think are all sorts of fascinating scribblings from the last 400 years or so of stuff which proves how things really work. One of the key things in there is some of the documents around the P2 scandal in Italy, which showed, and this goes back to John Robison's book, The Proofs of a Conspiracy, as well, because he mentions the propaganda lodges, is P2, the Propaganda Due Lodge in Italy in the 1980s, which was running the country from behind the scenes, run by a fascist grandmaster Freemason Licio Gelli, where they had all the bankers they had in there. They had the media tycoons, they had the oil energy barons, they had some of the senior party leaders in the country, all sitting around a table running the country from behind the scenes. And this is, you know, this is all documented. You don't often get the BBC looking into the secret government behind the scenes.
There it is,
and it was exposed beautifully. And that's the Siege of Heaven reader, which has got all sorts of little bits and pieces like that in there.
Yeah, you'll find them on Bilderberg.org or thisweek.org.uk. That is brilliant. What you've done there is collated evidence over the centuries to prove that secret societies were clubs, basically, cartels running governments and dictating the direction that governments were taking societies.
I think this is where the accelerationists come in, is that there is this need by the rich and powerful. They want to have people to pay to justify their ego and their power. They haven't got any moral justification for it, but it's a bit like Ayn Rand back in the 1940s. She came out with her own philosophy, which was basically trying to make selfishness seem good, you know, and normal and correct. And, you know, that's what the accelerationists are doing. So that we've got all these crises that they're creating, and false remedies to the crises that they're creating in lots of different areas, economic, climate, all sorts, war, etc. But ultimately, what about the end of the world? How about that for a crisis? They could be trying to create that too, I think. I mean, if you look at what this is all leading to, it's almost like the mother of all crises, where all these crises come together, including war in the Middle East, war between America and China all together. This, I think, is what their actual aim is, and that's why I'd really like to press Nick about if I ever get a chance to interview him.
Well, I hope you do, mate. Folks, you can listen to Tony Gosling every Friday at 5 o'clock, thisweek.org.uk. Check out Bilderberg.org for the books we mentioned. Great to have you back in the country, pal, and I look forward to speaking to you. I think we should make it our business to do another one of these before Christmas. And just thanks again, T.
All right. Thank you, and God bless Richie, and God bless you listeners.
Mind yourself, Tony. Tony Gosling, former BBC journalist, the presenter, the man behind, the producer of thisweek.org. Not the BCFM Politics Show. That is the name of the programme. It's live every Friday at 5 o'clock. And it's really a good listen. It's an important listen. Thanks to T for today.